All right, so this is our first episode.
It is indeed our first episode. Yep. It's very exciting.
You're Katie.
I am Katie, and you're Will.
I'm Will.
Yeah. And
we have been friends for a few years now.
About 2 years, I'd say.
Yeah, or three.
Maybe a bit less than that. No, I think it's less. No, it's more. You're correct. No, it was 2013 we met.
Okay, so like 2 years.
Two and a bit.
Two and a little bit.
A wee bit. Mm-hmm.
And now we're doing a podcast together.
We are indeed. Mainly because this is the basis of our friendship, is that we just talk about media and pop culture all the time.
Yes. So I think we should give a little intro about why we're doing this.
You can lead. I'll chip in.
Well, I have it prepared. That's why. It's easy to do.
Perfect.
So like you said, a lot of our friendship has been one long conversation about like books and TV shows and movies. And that's included a lot of like objective analysis and critique, talking about storytelling and cinematography and acting and character development. But it's also included a lot of discussion about like why these things we're watching or reading matter to us, like why these stories are important to us. So it's not just been why a particular thing is good or bad, but like why we care about it. And sometimes that's because some piece of media will tell us something about like our culture or society, or sometimes it's because it tells us something about other people and relationships, or because it says something about us personally and how we relate to other people or society or to ourselves.
Yeah.
And I think the point of contact between that kind of analysis and like the real life, why does it matter to us stuff, is where media is at its most interesting.
I agree.
So on the one hand, what we're going to do on this show is ask why stuff is good or bad, but also why it matters, or why it's important, why do we care about it, or why we should care about it.
Yeah.
And so that's been the underlying theme, I think, in our conversation and the conversation that happens with our group of friends.
Absolutely. So there's kind of the superficial reasons why you would like a show. You just think it's funny, or you're impressed by the cinematography or whatever. And then there's the deeper reasons why you connect with shows. And some of those are personal. Some of those is because it's, you know, super clear themes and that relate to the society that we currently all operate within. Other times because it's just striking a chord with you. It's great.
Yeah.
Media is amazing.
Yep. And so that's the idea of the show, is to bring that same kind of approach to a podcast. So we want to talk about books and TV shows and movies objectively, but we also want to talk about them personally. And if we have guests on, we want them to do the same thing.
Absolutely.
Cool. So that's the high-minded version of what we're doing.
Yeah. I was going to say, when you were saying it, you're like, yeah, you know, we can talk about things and critique them. And I was like, yeah, mainly you do that. Mainly me. It's very personal. I'm always like, my response to media is nearly always instinctually, how does this relate to me?
You do good. A lot of objective criticism.
I try. I try to put it in there. I try to keep it highbrow.
That's the highbrow version. The lowbrow version is it's just you and me talking shit about movies and TV shows and making jokes about them.
Absolutely.
So for our first episode, though, we want to talk about Buffy.
Because Buffy is the thing, right? It's the first piece of media that we actively engaged in, you know, together, and our friendship group have. It must be. So maybe that's where I'm confused. Has our collective viewing of Buffy been 18 months?
I don't know.
Maybe that's where I'm getting that from.
Maybe. I don't know. I mean, I started watching it and we were just messaging back and forth because you had been prodding at me to actually watch the show for a long time, like 6 months or something. And then I started watching. And then we brought in like a bigger group of friends, and we've for over a year have been doing like a group watch of Buffy the Vampire Slayer, which has been really fun.
Super fun. And I think it's a good show for us to start because, personally, it's important to the two of us because it's how this all started, how our critiquing of culture started. But also, it's important because the show is culturally important. So it's a good one to start with, I think.
Okay. So we should... I don't know if there's anybody listening who doesn't know what Buffy is, but I think I should give like a brief history of it.
Do a breakdown. Yeah, absolutely. Okay. I'd love to hear actually how Buffy can be explained in a very concise little paragraph there, because it's a wide-ranging and complex show. It's cool.
You can describe the show. I'll just talk about how it got made.
Okay.
I feel like I know that better than a description of the show, that it was originally... like a comedy horror film made in 1992. Starring Luke Perry and Christy Swanson as Buffy.
Yeah. Luke Perry at his most dreamy, like 90210 Luke Perry.
And Peak Perry. And the original script was written by Joss Whedon, but when the movie was made, I think it deviated a lot from the original script. And it was kind of a crappy movie.
Yeah.
Yeah. So
even I don't like it. Well, I mean, you know, whatever. Like is a very, yeah, but I wouldn't watch it. I would never sit down and be like, we should watch the original Buffy movie, which is maybe slander, but hey.
When we started watching the TV show, I watched the movie first and I read Joss Whedon's original script because I'm a completionist.
You are a completist. Yeah.
But so I guess the movie
to your detriment in this case.
To my detriment, it was really bad. But I remember as I was growing up, I really liked the movie, and I thought the TV show was stupid and for girls because it was on WB. Is part of the reason why.
I really don't understand this reference to WB. Is it because things like Dawson's Creek and stuff are on the WB?
Yeah, it has like a very like teenage drama vibe. And
so that would be like our equivalent of E4 in the UK. We have a channel called E4 and it's got things like One Tree Hill and all that kind of stuff on it.
Exactly. And so you just associate it with like low production values, bad acting, manufactured teenage drama.
Yeah.
So I watched the movie. But anyway, so it didn't do very well, I think. And then like in 1997, 5 years later, the WB picked it up as a TV show with Joss Whedon actually running it, and he kind of continued it based off his original script. So it's like sort of following the events of the movie, but not exactly. And then that was it. And then it ran for 5 seasons on the WB and 2 more seasons on UPN. And spawned spin-offs like Angel and comic books and video games. And yeah, that's it. That's the brief history of Buffy.
Brief history of the production of Buffy. That's cool. So the show itself is about a teenage girl who is a vampire slayer. So the whole speech is that there's one girl in all the world, and she's basically called upon by a group of, by a Watchers Council, which is a group of old dudes, largely, who basically use her as a weapon against vampires and, as the season expands, other demons and other kind of enemies of a non-human ilk. And basically, the story follows her progression in this role from being a 15-year-old in her... Now, what year is she in college? Is she a junior? I don't know how this works. So I think she's 15. So I don't know what... A freshman? How does that work?
That would make her a freshman.
Freshman. So it starts off with her as a freshman and it works all the way through to college and after. And she has her group of friends, and the show is... It's an ensemble piece with a strong lead. That's how I'd probably describe it, because I do think that it centers around Buffy's story centrally, but there are other stories that are developed off of that. And the show works to kind of, it develops into a show that looks at human relationships, human drama within this fantasy setting.
Right. And it uses a lot of like allegory, like.
Yeah. Totally.
Witchcraft as an analogy for drug use, or superpowers as an analogy for growing up and having responsibility. And
absolutely. And I mean, it is a show about growing up, but it's also a show about how you respond to the environment that you find yourself in. And Buffy finds herself put in a position that endangers her life on a regular basis, but also sort of gives her responsibility way above her years. So it's about how she deals with that as well. How does she deal at the age of 15 with having to risk her life to save people, having to choose who to save, you know, these kind of big themes and big decisions, and they're played out in this like fantasy universe. And yeah, it's, I mean, in the beginning, it's quite story of the week and it's quite high school-y. And whenever I ask people to watch it, I'm always minded that if they just watched the first season, they would think I was bonkers to be as obsessed with this show as I am. Because although there is a lot of quality in the first season, it's not really the value in the show. It's the later seasons that are stronger and more dynamic and more interesting and, you know, larger themes at play. But yeah, it's a fantastic show, which is why it's got a lot in it and it's very complex and it's great to talk about.
Yeah, and it influenced, I think, a lot of television at the time.
Yeah.
Like, was kind of this cultural juggernaut, even though I didn't watch it at the time. It is kind of bled out into all the other things that Joss Whedon has done and has influenced a lot of other similar kinds of TV shows and stories.
Yeah, I think Joss Whedon's success with The Avengers can probably be largely attributed to the experience he gained when working on Buffy the Vampire Slayer, because in Buffy the Vampire Slayer, similar to The Avengers, you have a group of people all with disparate powers and different strengths, and yet they have to kind of be seen as equal. So you have some characters that have superpowers like Buffy, and you have other characters that have zero superpowers and superhuman strength, for example, but they need to appear the same. And that kind of inequality is seen in the Avengers, because you've got, you know, Thor versus like Cap, who is what, super strong and has a shield. Like, it's not equatable to being a god with like a thunder, you know, the hammer. So
right.
I think a lot of his ability to even them all out and have them be pivotal to the action and the drama, etc., is, you know, he honed those skills on Buffy, I think. So yeah, you can definitely see how working on Buffy made Whedon, you know, a better, what would you call it, director, producer, writer, all of those things.
Mm-hmm.
I feel like he really cut his teeth on that show. He would probably say the same thing, but you know, he excelled. This show is amazing. It's not that it was stomping ground by any means.
And it's, I think it has a lot of influence in the idea of like fans analyzing and celebrating a TV show. Like the
yeah.
website TV Tropes, which I will probably reference a lot on this podcast.
Maybe too much.
is like a Wikipedia collection of tropes from stories, little story elements that you see over and over again in books and movies and TV shows. And that started as a fan site for Buffy to basically categorize all of the tropes that Joss Whedon used in Buffy, because it's a very self-aware show and it includes a lot of kind of typical story elements and events that you see a lot of times. But since it's self-aware, he's always kind of playing with them and playing with your
totally.
Expectations. And the whole premise of the show is based on the trope of the young blonde that gets killed in an alleyway by a monster, and it's the entire premise is a subversion of that trope, that what if
yeah.
instead of being killed helplessly in an alley, she actually turns out to be a superhero and all the vampires are afraid of her because she's a big scary slayer,
right? And I mean, I wrote a note about like earlier when I was thinking about this and what we were going to talk about, and it's like Whedon is a geek who writes for geeks. I mean, it's a really satisfying show to watch as someone that's really engaged with pop culture, because it is self-aware in this way, because it does exhibit a lot of the tropes that we see in other media and potentially establish them. You know, the true companions trope is one that we talk about quite a lot, but I think the fact that it's so self-aware also helps the viewer to not be kind of put off by the fantasy element of it, and you know, the kind of some of the sillier aspects of it. It stops that becoming a barrier to your enjoyment of the show and your ability to apply what happens in the show to your own experience. Because in real terms, if we look at it on a very logical comparison. There's no similarity between me and Buffy at all, other than the fact that we're both female. That is where the similarity ends. But I think because it is self-aware and because it does kind of know that it's a show and that it's playing with narrative and stuff, it almost invites you to say, it doesn't matter that me and Buffy are completely different, we can have similarity. And I think it does that in terms of the whole context of the show being that it operates in this fantasy realm. You can apply those non-human rules to the real world very easily, because it's almost pointing to the fact that this is just a catalyst for human drama. It almost signifies that in the way the show is actually portrayed.
Yeah, it doesn't take itself too seriously.
It doesn't.
So it helps you kind of turn off the, like, I have to be a stickler for all of the rules about the show, and I have to really understand everything that's going on and judge it as if it, you know, versus something like, I don't know, Lord of the Rings or a Game of Thrones, which is like this very tight, strict narrative that's supposed to be, even though it's in a fantasy setting, it's supposed to be the real world.
Yeah.
And this is more like, it's a fantasy setting, but we kind of know it's a fantasy setting, and that's part of the joke, and the characters characters kind of know it too, which helps you relate to them.
Yeah. And I mean, that is reflected in the format of the show, because this fantasy world is operating within our world. So they have so many pop culture references to things that are current, obviously not current now, but were current at the time. But also, not everyone knows about vampires and not everyone knows about demons. So again, it just helps the audience to be like, to connect with the parts of the show that might be, as you said, with things like Lord of the Rings and Game of Thrones, that can be barriers to actually engaging fully with a show. I find Lord of the Rings quite difficult to engage with. It's a very escapist kind of media. Like, I really enjoy it and I love watching it, but I don't feel compelled to compare myself to any of the characters in it, because I'm like, well, this is a story about a completely different world. Whereas Buffy, although it has otherworldly aspects, feels like a show about our world.
Yeah, no, it's totally right. All right, so why is Buffy so good?
Buffy the person or Buffy the show?
Buffy the show. Both.
So I think we've touched on some of the aspects on why Buffy's so great. The characters are amazing. It's well thought out. It's complex and complicated. And it addresses real world issues in an accessible way without, I think, kind of demeaning them by giving them kind of cursory treatment or whatever. But I think it has the whole package for me. It has good characters and it has good stories and good character development and consistency, which are things that I find lacking in a lot of shows. But I don't know. What do you think? What do you think makes it so special? I mean, there are specific parts of the show that make it individual. So like the Buffy speak and the general dialogue, you know, that is quite characteristic of this show, and I haven't really seen it repeated anywhere else, where the Scoobies, which is Buffy's little gang of friends, all use a very particular kind of vernacular to speak to each other. And it becomes a defining part of the show's identity. If you go on Etsy and Google Buffy on Etsy, or search Buffy on Etsy, it'll come up with loads of things like tote bags and stuff with phrases from the show. And I think the language, they had a lot of fun with it, but it also became part of the show's identity. So there are things like that that make it kind of exciting and fun to watch. But I think it's probably more than that that makes the show so good. What do you think?
Yeah, no, there's definitely those like kind of dynamic, oh, this is different from other shows I've read. The writing is like snappy and kind of sparkles. Mm.
Especially for the time when you compare it to shows like, you know, I like X-Files, but I never got as into it because it was just a bit, you know, like bland. People will kill me for saying that. People that love X-Files love X-Files, but it was bland in comparison to Buffy, I think.
Yeah, I haven't watched an episode of X-Files in like 10 years, so I can't make that comparison. But
I mean, that in itself tells you probably enough. I mean, I'm just saying.
No, right? Yeah, it's true. What was I going to say? Oh, one
I
of
cut
the
into you, sorry.
No, it's cool. One of the things about Buffy that I like is how it kind of sneaks up on you with emotional depth and drama.
Oh, yeah.
Because it's not kind of beating you over the head with it, and it's making jokes, and it's not taking itself seriously. You aren't as aware of how emotional it can get, and then something like one of the main characters dying, or someone being heartbroken, or some other kind of, you know, terrible thing happens to one of the characters, and you realize that, like, you're super, super upset about it.
Yeah.
Particularly season 5, which featured me crying at TV more than I think any other show in the history of my life.
And if you don't cry a lot at season 5, I think you need to kind of address your values as a human being.
Yeah, I think you might be a sociopath.
Yeah, you need to look into that. Yeah, I think because it does present as quite silly, and the characters in themselves are quite silly sometimes, and, you know, the way they all interact with each other is really funny. They're very cutting, and they make a lot of jokes at each other's expense, and it's really fun, and it's about how they all interact with each other. And then it can be undercut by moments of, like, seriousness without being too heavy. It just seems to get the balance very well, so that you don't turn on the show and think, oh god, I'm just gonna be super, super depressed watching this episode. Like, you never feel that, except in maybe one episode. But they're all quite well balanced, with moments of levity and moments of kind of soul crushing sadness.
Yeah, that's right.
And it can spin between the two very easily. So it's a really satisfying show to watch as the audience, because in each episode, you're taken on a bit of an emotional journey, you know, even in what we would call their, you know, like their funny episodes. They do a couple of season where they take something ridiculous and make an episode about it. So the most famous one is the musical episode, which I think even Buffy fans, if they've been on the internet, will have been exposed to at some point. But, you know, that, in that episode, some really important stuff happens, even though it's a comedy episode. So I think that's part of why it's a satisfying show. No moment in the show is throwaway. It's all kind of, arguably in the earlier seasons, there are some throwaway moments, but I think most of the moments are designed with this wider piece in mind. And part of that is probably because, if rumors are to be believed, Joss Whedon's just a complete control freak. But in this instance, it's paid off.
So you should talk about Buffy as a person.
Well, I think so our experiences of Buffy are both slightly different, because you've watched it as a fully formed adult, right?
Yeah.
And I watched it as a unformed teenager. So don't get me wrong, I'm not going to be one of these people that's like, Buffy made me believe in myself, and Buffy's the reason that I did X, Y, and Z, because that is nonsense. However, I do think that seeing strong women on TV is super, super important, and we can get onto that later. But I think Buffy as a character is really interesting, and I almost hate myself for saying that phrase, that Buffy is a strong woman, because I, you know, gender's problematic, and, you know, what does it really mean anyway? But I think it's to do with the fact that Buffy as a hero is very unconventional, because she's resilient, and she's vulnerable, and she's strong, and she's, you know, empathetic, and she has a lot of qualities that you just don't see in traditional hero roles. And it was interesting to see at the time, but it's still interesting. I still absolutely love her as a character. She goes through a lot of development from the beginning right until the end, and she's challenged in... She's challenged in so many ways throughout the show, and she kind of is always very surprising to the viewer. And what I love about all the characters in Buffy, but particularly Buffy, is that she's not perfect. She's not represented in a sort of cookie cutter, this is how this character should always act. You know, she makes lots of mistakes. She can be super mean sometimes. And there's definitely a kind of her interaction with one character, particularly, where you're almost rooting for the other character. And so I think having this kind of flawed dynamic individual leading the show was something that we hadn't seen before. And I definitely hadn't. And
how
so I think that's part of it.
When you were watching this?
I started watching Buffy when it was on TV. So I would have been, we got it a year later, I think, in the UK. So I'd have been like 16. No, I was younger. I was much younger, because Buffy was older than me. So I would have been 14 and Buffy was 16. So already I think she's the coolest person ever, obviously. And it definitely
So I was 28 when I started. So I was basically twice your age.
Right. And yeah, I mean, I think you're really heavily influenced by media when you're that age anyway. We won't go into you in the Matrix, but I think it's, no one talking about, but I think, so yeah, even if I wasn't culturally, even if I wasn't aware of it at the time, I think it was kind of important that she was on TV. And also at the time in the UK, we had a group called the Spice Girls, and they were all about hashtag girl power and, you know, the whole thing. So I think that element of it was important and probably did kind of in some way feed into my development as a human being, right? But I think also from a looking at it in terms of the other kind of media that was out at the time, it was different. And that is always intriguing because when I was a teenager, I strove for nothing more than I did strive for difference. I just wanted to be different to everyone because, you know, we're all unique, special snowflakes when we're 15. So, but what about you? How did you find watching it, especially the early seasons as a fully grown adult?
I mean, it's hard. It's hard to get through season one.
It is hard to get through season one. Just you have to power through.
Yeah, just because it's a 14-year-old show that had a low budget for its time.
Yeah.
Which means the production values are pretty terrible. Like, some of the sets look fake. A lot of the teenage acting in season one is very kind of, like, cheesy and teenagey. Yeah. But, I mean, you and everyone else who was already a fan of it basically said that's just, you know, season one was, it was growing pains and it was getting its footing. And then,
and lots of shows have bad season ones. Like, even Parks and Rec had a terrible season one where it's just trying to find its, you know,
its stride. Yeah.
Trying to find its footing. Yeah.
But a lot of the stuff I think that make it interesting or unique are still kind of interesting and unique about it.
I agree.
You were talking about how Buffy is more than a female character, but basically with male traits or what would be considered traditional masculine traits. Yeah. And a lot of times when you see, like, a female, you know, lead badass girl, she's female, but she basically behaves as if the character was written with a male in mind.
So the character that I always compare when we talk about this is Starbuck in Battlestar Galactica, who obviously originally was written as a male, and casting a female to play her doesn't necessarily undercut that representation.
Right. She's very masculine in the show. She's
traditionally,
like,
masculine. Right. Yeah.
Her behavior is coded as very, like, a guy, which is part of kind of her personality and the way that other people respond to her in the remake.
Yeah, totally.
But,
and they do some interesting things with that. I will say that they put her in some interesting situations when she's having to respond to having a child and things. Oh, spoiler alert for Battlestar Galactica. We'll have to put that in notes. But, you know, like, when she's responding to traditionally female roles, it's interesting to see her dynamic. But yeah, I think it's I always find it quite difficult when people reference people like her or like Dany from Game of Thrones. I'm like, well, you know, what is different about this representation of a hero compared to traditional representations of a hero? Not a huge amount.
Right. And Buffy is kind of this mix of strong superhero traits that I think would traditionally be considered masculine, but is also, like, very much a teenage girl in many ways.
Yeah. Yeah, totally. And I think, so I'll reference one particular scene. So any Kino Buffy fan listening to this might know the scene that I'm talking about, but it's in season four and she's being briefed on a mission. And the person that's talking to her about it, Buffy's wearing a crop top and or a halter. And the person that's talking to her about it starts looking her up and down and says, "Do you want to change?" And Buffy's so shocked that someone even asked her, and she's like, "Oh, this? Oh, no! I've slayed in this many times, you know." And it's just it's something to do with, not that she's a woman, she cares about clothes, or she's a woman and she's wearing a halter. It's not often about that. It's about the fact that you don't usually see heroes in positions like that, where they're being criticized for something that seems very arbitrary to them, you know, in that way. And it's, like, such a weird thing for this person to have commented on. And I think that when I struggle to think of examples of her being traditionally female or, you know, non-traditional hero. It's moments like that, I think, that give that fuller representation of her as a non-traditional hero.
Yeah, I think especially because in that scene, it's she's being compared to military guys.
Military gear. Yeah.
How much did it shape you being like obsessed with TV and movies and books?
So this is definitely interesting because this was literally my gateway drug to culture. So I can remember the exact moment, actually. I was 17 and I had been watching the show on television, right? And there was, I was friends with a girl called Catherine, who I thought was like the coolest person on the planet. I obviously at the time did not realize I had a crush on her, but I had clearly a massive crush on her. And I remember going to hers and she had like season 1, 2, and 3 of Buffy the Vampire Slayer in her bedroom. And it was back in the day because it was VHS because we're all 1,000 years old. And I remember seeing them and being like, oh, I could own this media. And then I could watch it all the time whenever I wanted and I could watch every episode. Because at this point, I'm basically watching episodes when I can because it's on TV and we don't have Netflix. And, you know, recording stuff in a house of 8 people is super difficult. And so I had a job. No, I didn't have a job at that point, but I got a job a couple of like weeks later. And I spent my first paycheck on Buffy the Vampire Slayer box sets, which at the time were a fucking fortune. So it was like $39.99 for 3 videos and you had to buy 6 videos to get the full series. So it was the first show.
It was $40 for half of a season?
Not even dollars, pounds.
But you're saying series in the British sense of each season, or you're saying the whole season?
No, each season. So each season, except season 1 because it's 12 episodes, each season was 6 VHSs and they were released slightly different times. So you'd get the 3, which was the first half of the season. And then maybe a couple of months later, you'd get the second half of the season, right? And each of those cost £39.99 in pounds, which is like, what is that in dollars? I don't know, lots of dollars. And so, yeah, and that was just, it was the first thing I spent my first paycheck on. I remember I went into HMV and bought them. So it was definitely my gateway drug. And I think it's a really good show to have been my first show that I got obsessed with because there's so much in it. And I used to buy all the, so I had all the Buffy memorabilia in my room because, you know, but I used to also buy the novels and stuff that were based on it and like wider canon things like that. And I used to go on the Bronze Forum and other forums and talk about it, you know. So it was definitely my way into like geek culture, because it was the first show that I remember thinking, actually, I want to own this show and I want to watch it all the time and know everything I can about it. So I would, read the novels and I bought things like the Slayer Slang Lexicon, which is about the speaking in the show. It's basically a lexicon of all the different phraseology and stuff. And I bought, you could buy the Watcher's Diaries for the seasons and I bought those. So everything, you know, very easy to buy gifts for when I was a teenager. You just buy me Buffy stuff. So gateway drug. What was your gateway drug? Star Wars?
Maybe.
Matrix?
No, it was earlier than The Matrix. Mm. Owning the idea of like owning and collecting things, feeding into your obsession with it, I think is definitely important because I don't remember. I mean, I remember the movies that I owned, I would watch over and over and over and over again and just study it from, you know, a million different ways because even if you aren't kind of consciously like, I'm going to analyze this, if you watch Terminator 2 50 times, during a couple year period, you just notice every single thing about it.
Yeah.
And you start to appreciate all these little things. And then as you get older, you start to understand, like, if you are interested, you start to learn about things like cinematography or script writing or how stories are supposed to work. And then you can connect it to like this knowledge that's just drilled into your brain by watching something over and over again.
Totally.
So I'm not sure what it was. I mean, it was definitely movies first. And it was probably toys also, the overlap between movies and being able to own the toys from the movies. Like the original Transformers cartoon movie and then being able to own the Transformers toys.
Oh, yeah.
Or Terminator 2 and being able to own toys from Terminator. And definitely Star Wars, because there were so many. I went through a period of buying every little like Star Wars figurine and Lego Star Wars stuff. And
Lego?
I think the Legos existed then. Oh, you're Lego. Talking about my accent.
Sorry. Lego.
Legos.
Sorry. This is going to be annoying for everyone, but I find it very charming. Carry on. Sorry.
No, I think that's part of going out and buying, you know, Boba Fett figurines makes you more obsessed with something.
Yeah. And I mean, I think I have a really addictive personality, and this unleashed it in a way that was quite controlled. And so I started with Buffy, and then I moved on to Angel, and then it just expanded, you know, it just became the way I approach all television and all film now. And I like it because it's fun, but it's also, yeah, it can be a downfall. Like, I have watched all of Lost and regret every minute of it, but I had to see it. And I remember watching it, and I'm one of these people where if I don't like something, I'll just rip it to shreds while I'm watching it, which annoys a lot of people because some people just want to watch it in silence or whatever. But I remember watching it and ranting about it somewhere. I can't remember where it was. And people just being like, why would you even bother? Why do you watch it if it makes you so angry? And it's like, well, I'm a completist, bro. I have to see all of it. Like, it's just in me to do that.
I've been hate watching things for years. So I completely understand. Every single Michael Bay Transformers movie in the theaters.
See, this is where we disagree, because I love those movies.
Okay, well, that's going to be a different episode, because
I love them. Yeah, but I have no taste. I'm like obsessed with Mission Impossible.
The Mission Impossible, I think, is accepted as being pretty good movies, except for number two or something.
Yeah, number two is not great. Number four is in my top 10 favorite films of all time. People think I'm joking. I'm obsessed with Tom Cruise, though. But again, this will probably come out later on. I'll have my shameful I love Tom Cruise episode. I do love him.
The Transformers movie are their own thing. Their own special cultural artifact that I just can't stop being obsessed with.
Totally.
Especially how bad they are. But anyway, I think Buffy, another reason Buffy triggered so many people to be like obsessed fans was that it was very, very well timed with like the rise of nerds finding each other on the internet.
Absolutely. So like before that, everyone has to operate in isolation or like post each other fanfic. How did that work? I mean, you know, Star Trek invented fanfic. How did that happen
before the internet? There was news groups and chat rooms and stuff that have been around since, you know, the late 80s, I guess.
Yeah, but Star Trek is 60s. How did they do it?
Oh,
it must have been a retroactive thing, I guess.
Didn't it not blow up until it was put in syndication?
Oh, yeah, maybe.
We're showing our lack of Star Trek knowledge here. But
Finn will murder me. He loves Star Trek. But anyway, up until this point, people, it's difficult, right, to find other people that are interested in your stuff. And as a result, I mean, you know, without the internet, so Catherine was the only person in real life that I could talk to about Buffy with constantly all the time, to the level that I wanted to talk about it with. So other people were aware of it and they could comment on it and they'd be like, yeah, that was a good episode. But I like, you know, obsessively analyzed it and wanted to talk about deeper meanings. And this is, you know, our first exposure to Why Do You Care, which is why we called it this, you know, where people who aren't engaged in culture in that way are kind of just, I think, what's the word that I would use? Mesmerized often by your level of knowledge of a show and your kind of investment in it, and sometimes horrified by your investment in something and how it can like genuinely affect your mood. You know, I remember Buffy finishing and being devastated, like genuinely inconsolable. But it definitely, as a show, it lends itself to that, but it also lends itself to being a fan of it. It delivers such fan service. I think all wedding products do that. They all deliver fan service.
I think part of it that added to it was Joss was aware of like the internet fandom and was posting on like the fan forums and responding to people.
Yep.
Which is crazy at the time. I mean, I think the idea that like for the generation before us that you could be watching a show and you could post what you thought about it on the internet and the creator of the show who is living in LA and making it would respond to you.
Yeah, I think so. I can't check it because I don't think it's online anymore. It might be archived somewhere. But my understanding is, and this could be a false memory, so forgive me if this isn't true, but my understanding is that the writers live did their version of live tweeting, but in the Bronze Forum of the final episode of Buffy. Now, it premiered in the States at a different time. So, you know, I might not have been on it because I might have been trying to avoid spoilers. But yeah, I remember looking at it years later and seeing like Joss and I think Douglas Petrie and a couple of other people had all, you know, been talking about the show when it was airing on the forum, you know, and that level of engagement is really common now. Like everyone in shows, especially actors and actresses, live tweet episodes. But I think that was quite new again for the era.
When did it end?
2001? 2003. Yeah, I think so, because it started in 97, 7. I can't remember off the top of my head. Yeah, 2003, I believe it finished.
Yeah, so that's crazy. I mean, that's definitely the type of thing that would just make you completely, totally invested as a fan.
Totally, yeah. It's all these elements that allow the show to reflect critically on society at large and, like, social structures and the big bads can often be diluted down to represent being representative of different social structures and oppressive kind of hierarchies. So obviously Buffy is part of an oppressive hierarchy in that she is a young, vulnerable girl who is being controlled by a syndicate of powerful, rich, old men, white men. And so that in itself is a... And her fighting against them throughout the show and challenging them is a representative of the, you know, challenge to patriarchy. But then,
and her purpose is to die. Technically, part of the Slayer purpose is that you will sacrifice yourself fighting monsters.
Yeah, this is your duty. You have to do it. You don't have the option of rejecting your Slayerdom. It's not, you're chosen. You don't choose. And so, the whole concept of the show is about when someone tries to force something on you, how do you interpret, you know, how do you respond? And so Buffy in the beginning, she isn't naive ever, I don't think, but she does what they tell her to do largely. You know, she fights back a little, but it's as the show goes on that she learns to really push. And I think that this is one of the things that's very satisfying as a fan. If you watch it from season one to season seven, you see that there's one overarching arc that goes across the entire series, and that basically is part of this wider critique of the patriarchy. But then additionally, the villains for each, we call them big bads, right? The big bads for each series can be reduced to either being representative of an oppressive regime. You know, one of them's military, one of them's government, one of them's religion, or they can be reduced to being representative of a kind of, how would you word it? A sort of big emotional / important relationship in someone's life, a partner, a friend, you know, a parent, whatever. And so I think that's another reason why we have talked about Buffy nonstop for 2 years, and we'll probably continue to talk about Buffy forever because we'll always find things in it. And I found this watch through that I've done with you guys. I mean, I must have watched certain episodes of Buffy definitely 100 times, maybe 200, who knows, because I watch it all the time. I have it on in the background all the time. But watching it with you guys, with a, you know, critiquing it and listening to your guys's takes on what was happening and different perspectives opened up the show to me in completely different ways. And I really was not arrogant going in, but I was like, there's no way that they're going to pick up on something that I don't pick up on. And one of the things I found so exciting about talking about it was the amount of times that I was like, oh my God, I never even thought about it in that way. So I think that's another reason why it's a great show for us to feature in this first episode, but it's just a great show for people to watch.
Yeah, I mean, I have only watched pretty much every episode once, so
there's... You've got your favorites though, right?
I have my favorites, but there's a, there's a depth to
one
them.
One of your favorites is weird, I'm just saying.
Which one of my, what's one of your favorites?
The season 5 one that you seem to watch a lot, and that is disturbing to me.
The really sad one?
The really sad one in season 5. I'm like, why are you a sadist? Why would you watch this episode?
I only watched it like 3 times.
That is still 3 times too many.
I watched it at night once the first time, and then I had to get up in the morning and like, I needed to rewatch it and make sure that like I wasn't just like out, I wasn't just crazy with how intense my emotional response was. And then when our group of friends was watching it and talking about it, I needed to watch it again.
I didn't even watch it again.
I needed to be on their level. But it made me cry every time for like a lot, an extended period. It wasn't like single tear coming down. It's like you're watching this episode, you're just crying during the 40-minute episode.
Just wailing on your own. But it's in your top 10 though, which is terrible. It should not be in your top 10. It's an incredible episode, but it's just so devastating.
it's one of the best, most well-made episodes of television I've ever seen.
Yes.
So like... Yeah. There's a difference between your preferences for how much you enjoy watching something versus the quality of it. And it is a hard episode to watch. You're not like getting a ton of enjoyment out of it, but it's like so well made that it's crazy. Yeah,
totally. I think, again, I mean, everyone pretty much is unified on their kind of feeling that Buffy was critically overlooked during its time, and I feel like a lot of people almost wanted to have retroactive Emmys. It did win the one Emmy for Hush, but I think it is one of those shows that is both massive fan service and enjoyed by fans, but is also critically very well kind of received.
It's on a lot of rare. Like best TV shows of all time lists.
Yeah, it makes all those lists, doesn't it? And like, you know, top 10 best characters, and you see it on, you know, there's horrendous Facebook ads all the time. Like, it's still current in those terms. You know, it still appears there. They're like, which Buffy the Vampire Slayer character are you, or top 10 characters or whatever. So I think, considering that the
show, I think those are just targeted to you based on your activities. Probably.
I'm sure it's not just, maybe it's just me.
I think a long time ago, the ad people figured out if we just show Katie Buffy ads, she'll click them.
She'll 100% take part in all of these quizzes and fix it so that she comes out a spike, which is what I do. I'm very aware. I'm not above it. I'm not above fixing an online quiz to tell me what I want it to tell me.
How do you know that you'll come out at Spike? Because the questions are just so obvious.
They're so obvious. Are you a bad boy? Tick yes. Yeah. Do you have vampires and bleached hair? Yes. Anyway, it's vampire fangs, not vampires. But yeah, it's you can definitely... Come on.
Is Spike your favorite character?
Definitely. Isn't he yours?
No. No way.
Do you know what? I always say this, but actually Spike and Buffy probably are tied. I love Buffy so much. I think they swing in oscillation. But yeah, the two of them are my favorite characters in the show, definitely. In the Wedding universe, Spike is probably my favorite character.
Yeah, I think that's Wesley for me now, but we got to save that for the Angel episode.
Wesley's my number 3. Cordy's my number 4.
Yeah,
Andrew's my number 5.
Wesley and Cordy are high on mine, and Buffy's kind of like, you feel like you have to have her at number 1. But there's some seasons where she pisses me off. But after season 5, you're like, she is like so heroic and awesome. How can you not have her at number 1?
No. And so many quizzes do that. They put her at like number 4. And I'm like, not quizzes, like, you know, top 10, top 50 characters in Buffy. And then like put Buffy at 4, like Willow's above her. I'm like, come on, guys. Come on. Anyway. Spoils.
That's a spoiler.
I don't know. Is it?
I don't think so.
Maybe.
I think Willow's a lot of people's favorites.
Ugh, why? Sorry. That's a terrible response. She's lovely.
People love Allison Hannigan also.
Why do people love Allison Hannigan? I find it kind of irritating.
She's nice and genuine. And when her cry face is like heartbreaking in every show that I've ever seen her in.
That's true. Not as heartbreaking as Sarah Michelle Gellar's, though. Her cry face absolutely destroys me. I can't, even now, it makes me sad thinking about it. Like I can feel the wells coming on.
Are you okay? No,
I'm fine. Sorry. I took a deep breath. I'm okay. Allison Hannigan's too mousy. It's annoying. She needs more gumption. She's really sickly sweet. Like on Twitter, I followed her for a while, but she kept tweeting pictures of her kids' lunches. And I was like, dude, I don't care about the fact that you can make a teddy bear out of a sandwich. Like, this is not the content I wanted from you at all. Like, please deliver better content. Your friend, Casey. Yeah.
Did you actually tweet her that?
No. That would go viral. Prick fan harasses sweetheart Allison Hannigan.